Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it feels a little like the heady days of Tahrir Square again in Egypt this week, with the presidential election underway and most reports saying it is being conducted fairly and openly. Plus, liberal and secular candidates, as well as military and Islamist ones, are reported to have a real shot. Let's look at the Egyptian elections and more now through the lens of Fawaz Jurjes, director of the Middle East Center at the London School of Economics. His latest book is Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment. Fawaz, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
Before we get to Obama, the Egypt elections themselves, do you see this as a moment of great hope for establishment of a meaningful democracy there for the first time?
It's not just me. Egyptians are extremely optimistic about this particular moment. The reality is this is a great historical moment, the freest elections since 1952, when the Egyptian military seized power, you know, during the Egyptian revolution when Gamal Abdel Nasser became the president of Egypt. Also this represents another building block in the transition from Mubarak to a new pluralistic system. Egyptians, Brian, are discovering the political. They are really coming to trust the political. We have evidence before during Mubarak, 10% of Egyptians, less than 10% used to vote. Now we're talking about 50, 60, 70%. And this tells you it's a very important point because Egyptians are being socialized into the political, and this is a very promising moment.
And what a roller coaster from the hope for Egypt, hope for the world, represented at Tahrir Square, through the dark days where it looked like the military was going to kind of sublimate the whole thing, to a point where a lot of people didn't like the candidates who were emerging because it seemed like just one version of Islamist or another, to now where it seems like a free and fair election from the democracy standpoint, and that a diversity of candidates has a real shot.
You're absolutely correct. The military has fought tooth and nail to remain basically in control. Even though I believe that the military will likely relinquish power at the end of June when the president is installed, the military will not submit itself to a civilian authority. Have no doubts about it. They want to maintain their privileges, they want to maintain authority over their budget, and they want to serve as checks and balances just in case. So let's keep things in perspective. This is the first, you might say, it's another building block on the road to really become a pluralistic system. It's not the end of the road, it's the beginning, Brian.
Who do you think is the most likely winner of this presidential election? And where would that person fall on the spectrum of secular to Islamist or military to civilian rule oriented? Because I believe one of the top two is set to kind of represent the military.
I think the beauty about this election is that we don't know who's going to win, truly. And this is by itself a testament to the volatile democratic process. This is the first time since 1952 Egyptians do not know what kind of candidates will emerge on top. I think there are two sets of candidates, Brian, here. Even though Egyptians have choices, you have 13 candidates. Unfortunately, from the point of view of many Egyptians, you have the Islamists and you have the members of the old regime. So you have the two leading members of the old regime who or have affiliations are Omar Moussa, the former foreign minister, and another general, General Ahmed Shafiq. On the Islamist side, you have the leading member of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Morsi, and you have a liberal Islamist. I think he's one of the most promising candidate, Abdul Mun'im Abul Futuh. He was a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood. He rebelled against the Muslim Brotherhood. He was expelled, and now he is a liberal-minded Islamist Democrat, and he is really co-opting both liberal Islamist and secular liberal Egyptians. He is the most promising, but no liberal-minded or secular liberal-minded candidate has emerged so far.
Fawaz Jurjes commenting on the elections in Egypt. The polls closing right around now, I believe, Egypt time, and it's going to take a good few days for them to sort out the results, I understand. Professor Jurjes also has a new book called Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment, and it was in Cairo that President Obama gave his first major address as president, targeted as to the Muslim world. trying to distinguish himself from his predecessor, George W. Bush, back in 2009. And of course, Mr. Obama didn't say, Mr. Mubarak, tear down this wall. So how do you look back on the importance of the Cairo speech?
Well, I think, Brian, many of us on the right and the left really misunderstood Barack Obama. We misunderstood Barack Obama because we thought that his outreach strategy to Muslims, his speeches in Ankara, Turkey, Cairo, Egypt, and Jakarta, Indonesia, were really an attempt to basically change American foreign policy dramatically from that of his predecessor. We were wrong. In fact, not only the Middle East does not really top Barack Obama foreign policy priorities, Barack Obama is deeply anchored within the dominant American foreign policy approach. Barack Obama has always said he was a realist. He does not really want to promote democracy. He does not really want to preach to other nations. The reality is his outreach to Egyptians and Turks and Indonesians was an attempt, Brian, to mend the historic rift that was created as a result of the 9/11 wars. He wanted to basically rebuild the bridges of trust and shift American foreign policy priorities from the Middle East to the Pacific region. He and his foreign policy believe that America's future lies in Asia and the Pacific region, not in the Middle East. And that's why many of us looked at his speeches and misunderstood the substance of his strategic thinking and foreign policy.
So what about Obama and the two big wars in that respect? He first ordered a withdrawal from the unpopular war in Iraq. Now, Bush had already more or less agreed to a drawdown because the Iraqi government had demanded it. But Obama still ordered a full withdrawal, coupled with a troop surge in Afghanistan, seen by many in the U.S. as the good war, but with the intention of engaging there, too, by 2014. And that seems to be on track, although that war seems to be mired in many failures at the same time and is unpopular in both countries. And yet I think politically here, at least, Obama is largely viewed as a success for building up at the right time, killing bin Laden, and now planning to get out. How is he seen with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan around the Middle East, if you can generalize?
Barack Obama's greatest political achievement, I would argue, is his ability and desire to reduce the American military boots in Muslim lands. That's the reality. And the decision was made by Obama and his foreign policy team from day one to begin the process of this engagement. In fact, they believed that America had over-engaged itself in the shifting sands of the Middle East far beyond what its strategic interests lie. Even though they were reluctant to pull all American forces from Iraq, he wanted to pull American forces from Iraq, and he did. In fact, the surge in Afghanistan, I would argue, was forced on Barack Obama by domestic necessities, by the American security apparatus. The reality is, the big picture is the following. The surge has failed to basically weaken the Taliban in Afghanistan. The Taliban in Afghanistan remains as potent as it was a few years ago. Unfortunately for the Afghani people, the Taliban will likely play a key role in the future of Afghanistan, and American forces will most likely be out of Afghanistan in the next year or two.
We can take phone calls on Obama and the Middle East or the Egyptian elections. Any Egyptian Americans listening right now want to call and express the hope, if it is hope, that you're feeling represented by these last 2 days of presidential voting? 212-433-WNYC. Or how does President Obama's overall policies toward the Middle East as a region affect your likelihood to vote for him, or just your assessment of the Obama administration? With Fawaz Georges, author of Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post your comment or question to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Just to stay on that point about the wars for a second, opponents of early withdrawal from Afghanistan and Iraq, like Senator John McCain, say one problem is that U.S. allies, including those in the Muslim world, could come to distrust our government's commitments. We might say we'll be there to back them up one day, but when the domestic politics change, later for you, buddy. Do you see that distrust materializing?
Nonsense. It's nonsense, Brian, because you and I, we have spoken on this program many times in the past. The presence of American boots in Muslim lands is one of the most insidious factors in relations between the United States and the Muslim world. In fact, it has served as a, I mean, product, as a factor in providing ammunition to radicals and militants in that part of the world. In fact, the most, the best that Barack Obama has done so far is to what I call deactivate the cultural minefields between the United States and the Muslim world by beginning to reduce American forces from that part of the world. And remember, the majority of Afghanis, the majority of Iraqis, the majority of Arabs and Muslims would like American forces out of their Muslim lands. And they used the presence of American forces in Muslim lands to say that America was an imperial power, America was engaged in a social engineering project against their own people and identity.
In fact, when we look at the roots of Osama bin Laden, and you've written books on radical jihadis since before 9/11, how strong do you think the presence of U.S. troops on Saudi soil after the first Gulf War was in developing Osama bin Laden's radicalism?
You know, this is a great question, Brian, and this is not an ideological question. In my book, The Far Enemy, Why Jihad Went Global, in fact, I argued that the presence of American forces in Saudi Arabia after the Iraq War in 1991 was the catalyst that basically brought Osama bin Laden to the killing fields of Sudan and Afghanistan. In fact, he made it very clear. Before 1991, Osama bin Laden and the jihadis were in the same trenches as the United States and the Western powers against the evil empire, the Soviet Union.
We'll continue in a minute after a short break. And when we do, I want to get to the subtitle of your book, which is The End of America's Moment, because ultimately you see a decline in U.S. influence in the Middle East and the rise of regional powers, both economically and strategically. So we'll find out who you think those are. We'll get your take on how Obama has done in the Israel-Palestine situation and go to some of our callers, 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with London School of Economics professor Fawaz Jirjaz. Many of you may remember him from his Sarah Lawrence, where he promised in radical jihad before 9/11, came on this show for the first time just after 9/11, and has had so many conversations with us about those kinds of topics. And his new book, Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment, and that question in the subtitle, Fawaz, ultimately you see a decline in U.S. influence in the Middle East and the rise of other countries in the region?
Brian, I'm not the only one who sees America's relative decline, not just in the Middle East, but throughout the world. And really, the book is not just about Barack Obama, the Barack Obama presidency. This is about American foreign policy in the Middle East since the beginning of the Cold War in 1947. And in the book, I argue there has been a revolt brewing in that part of the world against Western domination. And that particular revolt culminated in the 9/11 wars that launched by the neoconservatives in the United States with the project of social engineering in that part of the world. In fact, the irony, the historical irony, is that the 9/11 wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan were supposed to consolidate American dominance, according or hegemony, according to the neoconservatives. The irony is that the 9/11 wars, in fact, have brought about the opposite result, have weakened America structurally in that part of the world. It's not just about America's credibility. It's not just about America's moral standing. It's about the economic costs of the war. We have spent, Brian, between 9/11 and the present, we have spent between $3.5 and $5 trillion on the 9/11 wars itself. So in addition to, I mean, the costs that have exacted a great deal on American economy, you also have in the region itself the rise of public opinion, what I call a new awakened public opinion, a new awakened public opinion that would like to take charge of its own destiny. to really own its history, in addition to the rise of geostrategic and geoeconomic powers like Turkey and Iran and now Egypt if the transition takes place.
Although one of the characteristics of the Arab Spring as a whole, I think, has been that it has not been about the usual politics of resenting the U.S. and Israel, but rather focused on internal issues of non-democracy and economic inequality. Did that represent, as you see it, a sophisticated understanding on the part of Middle Eastern peoples that their governments were often using the U.S., using Israel as distractions from their bigger homegrown problems?
I think you're really putting your finger on a very, very important question here. I think more and more Arabs and Muslims are coming to realize that their tormentors are the authoritarian leaders who promise heaven and deliver dust. More and more Arabs and Muslims, young and old, female and man, are beginning to realize the United States is not really responsible for all the ills and misfortunes that have befallen their world. And here you ask me about Barack Obama, what he has done. One of the most important points that Barack Obama has been able to do, he has been able to shift the debate from the poisonous foreign policy to questions of development, institutions, domestic politics. This is his legacy. He wanted, because remember what has happened after what happened after 9/11, the whole grievances, set of grievances against the United States and the Western powers. And now we are seeing now a new public opinion is interested in institution building and empowerment in what they call in Arabic al-karama, dignity, bread and butter, and, of course, a new society, pluralistic society.
And his critics on the right see the president as squandering U.S. power for taking this back seat.
In fact, Barack Obama, in 3 years and a half, has done much more good to American foreign policy in that part of the world than really the last, truly, 30 or 40 years. Because of the bitter inheritance that he had, when W. Bush left office, Brian, the United States reached the lowest points in its relations with the Arab and Muslim world. And what Barack Obama has been able to do so far is to try to really bridge that particular gap. I'm not suggesting that Barack Obama has done greatly. That's not the question. But Barack Obama had a bitter inheritance, a bitter legacy. And you cannot understand his foreign policy, which has some major holes, without understanding the bitter inheritance that he had.
Abdullah in Morristown, you're on WNYC. Hey, Abdullah. Abdullah, can you hear me? Let's see. Is he on the wrong line there? Can we do something about that?
Yes,
Abdullah,
hello?
Hey, now we got you. Sorry about that.
Hello. This is what I would like to say. First, for Egypt, this is a great moment because you are bringing democracy to the Middle East. And the people, you know, democracy, even for the United States in 1776, it's messy. It's not always clean. So that's a wonderful thing. As far as this book, you know, the name is End of Obama's Dream or Obama's Moment. Or what is that correct?
Let me thank you for your question because you're really forcing me to explain, elaborate. The end of America's moment, the beginning of the end of America's moment was a question mark. Question mark means the end of America's dominance that used to be between 1947 and the beginning of the 9/11 wars. We are seeing now America's is no longer as dominant as it used to be. First of all, because of economic decline, because of the credibility gap that exists in the eyes of the people there, and also because of the rise of what I call an awakened public opinion in that part of the world that would like to take a charge of its own destiny, and the rise of a new geostrategic and geoeconomic powers there. And final point on this question, Brian. The end of America's moment is not a bad thing. It's a good thing, because finally people are taking charge of their own destiny, and people no longer, hopefully, when pluralistic societies are put in place, will no longer blame the United States for everything that happens in that part of the world. So the end of America's hegemony in the Arab world, in the Middle East, is a good thing for the United States and for that part of the world as well.
And I wonder if this was both inevitable and in the United States' interest, inevitable as a result of the end of the Cold War, even if delayed by 20 years, because U.S. influence in the Middle East was largely motivated by staving off Soviet power in addition to the oil.
I think, again, this is a very important point. This is really, it was inevitable. I mean, two things. First, the end of the Cold War, the rivalry between the United States and the Soviet Union really brought to an end the logic and rationale for America's hegemony in that part of the world. The most important factor, Brian, in this story is the presence of authoritarian leaders, that they were seen by their people as basically contractors for the United States. I mean, Hosni Mubarak was seen literally by Egyptians as a contractor for the United States. And that's why I'm saying the rise of a new public opinion, an awakened public opinion in that part of the world, basically also expedites the decline of America's dominance in that part of the world.
Jacob in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jacob. Whoops, I'm sorry.
Trillion of dollars that were spent by the American government on the two wars.
Jacob, forgive me. I missed the beginning of that because I pressed the wrong button. Now you're on. Start over.
Your guest mentioned the trillion of dollars which was spent on the war on Afghanistan and Iraq, yet Egypt has the nine largest army on earth. The millions of dollars spent on an army which I don't understand who they are afraid of. Sudan cannot conquer Egypt, nor Libya. Israel mainly able to control the Gaza Strip and left. Why does Egypt does not allocate those money to the economy? A country that spends $1,000 per capita a year, the money should go to industry and not to the army.
Jacob, as an Israeli-American, are you concerned on behalf of Israel that Egypt in the new democratic era would maintain such a large army?
Of course, absolutely. I mean, I don't understand why the entire budget of all the Arab country surrounding Israel should be at that size. I don't understand why the money does not go. The Egyptian army, I understand, is a very big part of the economy of Egypt, 30% or 40%, and build the washing machine. Based on the system, the Soviet system. But my fear is that when I read about Amer Moussa and I read about all the statements that question the future of the peace accord, mm-hmm. when the slogan of the Amer Moussa is, we love Amer Moussa, we hate Israel. Of course you worry about. And Amer Moussa, I mean, have built his future, political future, being an anti-Israeli compared to Mubarak. I'm very proud and happy about what's happening in Egypt. And I hope that there will be, we should have the Marshall Plan for Egypt. They should be industry and not military and not army.
Jacob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jacob.
So let me break that into two parts, and we don't have much time left.
But How much time do we have?
We've got about 3 or 4 minutes. Historically, why did Egypt maintain such a large military if there was no possibility in the Mubarak era that they would ever attack Israel?
I mean, the question, there are really multiple elements within the question. But let's flesh out the question and talk about domestically, regionally, and internationally. Domestically, and this is a very important point for your listeners, Brian, the military, the question of the military is the most important question in whether Egypt basically transitioned to a democracy or not. That is, will the military allow the civilian leadership to exercise control? Will military relinquish power in the real sense, as opposed to being really running the things behind the scene? Egyptians are extremely nervous, much more nervous than you and I. And it is, Egyptians will likely find a way out of this particular predicament. The second question, and Jacob really, insinuated, the military in Egypt is not a fighting machine. It's a welfare institution. It's an economic power. Mm-hmm. We estimate, Brian, that between 10% and 40% of the economy is controlled by the military. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, I mean, Egypt was in a state of war with Israel from 1952, up to 19, really, the peace campaign.
79.
And finally, on the peace treaty, there is no credible political force in Egypt that has questioned the legitimacy of the Camp David Agreement. Not even the Muslim Brotherhood, not even Abu al-Futuh, not even Umar Musa. When Umar Musa, he was asked on television debate whether he regards Israel as a hostile, as an enemy state. Guess what he said? He refused to say that Israel is a hostile state.
We are out of time, except for one final question. And as many of our listeners know, we're asking many guests in these few months who are concerned with issues of war and peace our end-of-war question, based on a book by John Horgan called The End of War. We're doing a series that includes asking many people, do you think it's possible for humanity ever to abolish war? Or is war inevitable? Horgan, if you're familiar with that book, argues that humanity could abolish war, just as we abolished slavery, which used to be an acceptable institution all over the world. Have you thought about the question?
Well, my field, I am a professor of international relations. The very existence of international relations had to do with the question of abolishing war itself. That is, students and scholars of international relations and politics and philosophy really have tried to find ways and means about really whether war will persist or not. My take on it, Brian, is that we have the ability as human beings because we have the will and the intelligence. But how do you deal with the question of greed, power, influence, and control? These are also deeply ingrained, unfortunately, in the human species. And that's why the struggle goes on till we find a way out of this particular deadly embrace.
Fawaz Jurjess from the London School of Economics, his new book, Obama and the Middle East, The End of America's Moment. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.